Yeah, thanks, Michael, for the introduction and also for the kind invitation. So today I'll talk a bit about some work that I did still during my PhD at Harvard mostly, plus some new results, or you know, preliminary recent results. The topic is going to be quantum algorithms for quantum sampling problems. So just want to say here, if you have any questions or want to discuss anything, just please stop me at any time. Much of this, the main part of this work was published in these two papers. So have a look. Also, if you have any questions later on, just feel free to contact me anytime. With that, let me just sort of jump right in and give a bit of a motivation here. So why sampling problems? Why quantum algorithms for sampling problems? And I think if you've followed the news at all in sort of the quantum world recently, you will have encountered these sampling problems quite a lot. So maybe two prominent examples here, even though they may be a little out of date already. That's this experiment here by Google, where they demonstrated or claimed to demonstrate some quantum advantage over a problem. And the problem here was just to sample from a probability distribution that is defined in sort of a very implicit way, namely in terms of just some random quantum circuit that prepares a state, and then you measure the state and that gives you a probability distribution. And it's believed to be hard to do this on a classical computer, but this quantum device could do this quite well, with some noise, but quite well still. So of a similar idea is the idea of boson sampling. So here, instead of a random quantum circuit, you have some interferometer, some optical paths that can interfere with each other. And the goal is to sample from the output modes and sample the photons that come out, which again is believed to be classically hard. But what's common to both of these experiments is the sampling problem is defined in this very implicit way. It's defined in terms of some quantum circuit and you can't, or some interferometer. You can't just dial in any distribution that you want. And this means that these things are maybe not so practically useful because yes, you're sampling from something, but a priori you don't really know what you'll be sampling from. So what we want to do is actually try and have a bit more control over this probability distribution. And with this, we can kind of just turn around this problem. We can just say, well, okay, we can always construct a state that just encodes some probability distribution. And we can think of any quantum state as just naturally encoding some sampling problem. You know, this quantum state psi that I've written here, it just encodes the entire probability distribution P of S. If I just measure in this fixed basis, I don't even have to worry about these phases. One thing we could try and do is we can just take some probability distribution that we're interested. For instance, a classical Gibbs distribution with some classical Hamiltonian or energy HC here, and some condition function here as the normalization constant. And then you sum over all the states in the configuration state space with this. And then you can say, well, this state psi here encodes the entire Gibbs distribution. If you measure in this basis, you'll get the configuration S with probability according to the Gibbs distribution. So I'll refer to this state as the Gibbs state, maybe a bit of an abuse of language. By Gibbs state, I don't mean the mixed state of sort of the thermal ensemble. I really just mean this pure state, which is this superposition. And what we've done here now is we've just connected the sort of a sampling problem to a state preparation problem. So if you want to go down this route of solving a sampling problem, what you have to do is you have to go ahead and prepare the state and then measure. The measurement step is easy, so the hard part is going to be how to prepare the state. And we know that many of these sampling problems, they can be extremely hard, right? Imagine sampling from a spin glass at low temperature, or sampling also shows up in sort of optimization algorithms where you do simulate the annealing often. And we also know some of these problems can be extremely hard. So we don't expect that the state preparation is going to be easy generically. We're going to expect that there may be problems where it's easy, there may be problems where it's hard, And what we're trying to understand is how does it connect to just the classical complexity of sampling from this probability distribution. Maybe there is some quantum advantage to be had here by choosing this way, this particular way of sampling. So before I jump into how we prepare the state, I'll just remind you of sort of a very simple way of solving a sampling problem classically. So imagine you have some classical spin system. So each spin either points up or down, and you try to sample from this, according to its Gibbs distribution. One standard way to do this is with Markov chain Monte Carlo, what you could do, for example, is you pick any spin at random, and then you try to flip it. And you flip it with a probability given by this expression here. So beta is the inverse temperature, delta E is the change in energy going from this original configuration to the configuration where the spin is flipped. And then you just repeat this. Now, this procedure is described by a Markov chain. So the probability distribution at time t plus one is just related to the probability distribution at the previous time step t. And then there's this sort of this update matrix. This tells you basically what's the probability of going from configuration S to S prime, which in this example up here is just will be non-zero only if S and S prime are related by a single spin flip. And then the exact transition, the matrix element will be given by this expression here, essentially. We call this matrix M the generator of the Markov chain. We chose this rule up here because it satisfies a particular property, which is detail balance. And detail balance just says the transition probability going from S to S prime is related to that going the other way from S prime to S by these Boltzmann factors here. And what that does is it basically ensures you can check that quite easily that the Gibbs distribution is a stationary distribution of this Markov chain. You can also guarantee that it's the unique stationary distribution with some other assumptions, mainly related to sort of the ergodicity of this Markov chain. So if it's fully mixing and aperiodic, this will be the unique stationary distribution. If you wait long enough, eventually you'll be sampling from the Gibbs distribution. And now we're going to use this construction to sort of get something. This is all classical. We want to relate this now to this Gibbs state that we find earlier. And there's sort of a standard construction. I don't think this was the first paper, but this is maybe the paper where I learned about it, which is you can just take this generator matrix and do a similarity transformation. And because of detail balance, you can quite easily see that the resulting matrix, what I call HQ, is real and symmetric. So that means it is a valid Hamiltonian. Yeah, it's Hermitian, so we can just call it a Hamiltonian. You can also check that the skip state that I found earlier is a ground state of the Hamiltonian. And so under the mixing assumptions of the Markov chain, it's in fact a unique ground state of this Hamiltonian. And then the sort of last important point is that the gap between the ground state and the first excited state of the parent Hamiltonian, so I'll call this the parent Hamiltonian because its ground state is beside the state that we want, the gap between the ground state and first excited state of the parent Hamiltonian is just equal to the gap between the largest and second largest eigenvalue of this matrix M. And this is known to be basically the inverse mixing time of the Markov chain. It tells you roughly how long does it take for my Markov chain to reach, in the worst case, to reach a stationary distribution. And so we can again see here already by this construction, we've not really gained much yet because if there is a hard problem, classically hard problem, where M mixes slowly, so it has a large gap, a small gap, then the parent Hamiltonian will also have a small gap, and intuitively it's quite hard to prepare ground states of Hamiltonians with a small gap. So according to this hand-waving argument of hard problems will map into hard problems, and it's not quite clear what this construction has brought us. But with this, I can sort of present to you the rough idea of this work. So you know, as I said, we start from some sampling problems, and we choose here a classical Gibbs distribution that we sample from. And then the first thing is we pick just some classical algorithms to sample from it. This is a Markov chain algorithm. And you can pick these single spin flips that I gave the example for earlier, but you can also pick something more complicated. Then using this, you compute the parent Hamiltonian, and you know that the grand state is the thing that you want. So it's all relatively straightforward. And then comes the tricky part, which is you have to find some sort of efficient way of preparing this. And we want to do this adiabatically. So we're going to start with some initial Hamiltonian whose grand state we know and can prepare. So it's something relatively simple. And then we want to deform this Hamiltonian into the final Hamiltonian in such a way that the gap remains relatively large and sort of there are as few non-adiabatic transitions as possible. You might be a bit skeptical of this because the gap of the final Hamiltonian is still just determined by the Markov chain, so it can't be, it's determined by the classical algorithm. But I'll show you some examples where you can actually still get some speed up by doing this, by judiciously choosing what this path is. So then once we've done that, and this is really the hard step, then you put this on your quantum device, you prepare the state, you measure, you get a sample from the distribution. And I think what's one real advantage of this procedure is that these samples that you get, because they're always drawn from a new preparation of the state, they'll be entirely uncorrelated. So it's very different from Markov chains where you have this problem that there's some finite correlation time and you have to wait for a sufficiently long time to get rid of these correlations. Here, it's really just, if you can do this, then at least you get unbiased samples. So let's just illustrate this with sort of the simplest example you can think of, right? And this is always, I think, the easing chain, simplest non-trivial example maybe. So we take an easing chain, sampling from the Gibbs distribution of easing chain is easy because we can just write down exactly the partition function and everything. So this is exactly solvable model. It's not hard, but I think it illustrates a lot of the physics. The thing we had to pick is the Markov chain. And what we pick here is we're going to do single spin flip updates. And the update rule is going to be what's called Glauber dynamics. So it's not quite the probability that I wrote down earlier. Sorry, just go back to it. It's not quite this probability, which is sort of this Metropolis-Hastings rule, but it's something slightly different. It's almost exactly the same. It doesn't really make a difference, but it makes the analysis a bit more convenient. And then you get a Hamiltonian, parent Hamiltonian that looks like this. But you can kind of understand where this comes from. So there's still this easing term. There is this transverse field term, which is just has to do with the fact that we're doing single spin flip. And then there's this three-body term. And this three-body term accounts for the fact that when you're doing a single spin flip, you have to check the nearest neighbors to see, should I be flipping the spin or not? What's the probability that I'll check it? And then these functions, h, j1, and j2, those are just functions of temperature. At each temperature that we want to sample, we get a different parent Hamiltonian with a different ground state, which corresponds to the Gibbs distribution at that temperature. We can plot what these parameters are, and we get sort of this segment of a parabola here. So at infinite temperature, beta equals zero, we have J1 and J2 are both zero. That makes a lot of sense because then we just have a transverse field. The ground state is everything aligned along the X direction. And that's just an equal superposition of all the computational basis states. So that's an infinite temperature Gibbs state. The zero temperature limit is a bit more interesting because now J1 and J2 are actually non-zero. It's not sort of the naive thing that you would expect where you get the classical Hamiltonian back and the ground state of the classical Hamiltonian is the Gibbs state, you actually get something a bit different. You still have these other two terms, which I think maybe the first surprise. So, what's also convenient about this model is this quantum Hamiltonian is exactly solvable, right? This can be mapped onto free fermions with a Jordan-Wigner transformation, so we can just draw in the phase boundaries in yeah, we can just draw up a phase diagram. And what you have is, yeah, let's first consider J2 equals zero. And then we have a transition from a paramagnet to a ferromagnet. It's just a transverse field easing model. You can also consider the other axis where it's set J1 equals zero. This is a model that's been studied before as well. So if J2 is dominant, then this term, basically, the ground state ends up being a 1D cluster state. This is the stabilizer of the 1D cluster state. So there is at some point a phase transition from a paramagnet to something that looks like a cluster state. And this is actually a symmetry protected topological phase transition. I won't say much more than that, but so it's kind of a bit of an unusual situation. And what's also remarkable is that this zero temperature point of in parameter space corresponds exactly to a tricritical point where all these three phases come together. So that the black lines here denote where the gap closes in the spectrum. If you vary the parameters, and here you really have these two phase transitions coming together. So now, yeah, the key idea is basically how are we going to do adiabatic state preparation in this model, you know, according to this prediscription that I drew up earlier. So yeah, I think as an initial state, an initial Hamiltonian, I think this infinite temperature point is quite appealing. The Hamiltonian is very simple. It's just a transverse field. The ground state is so simple. It's a product state. So let's just start here. And we somehow want to prepare these other states. Anything along this red curve is easy if you don't go to the zero temperature point, because here we remain in a gap phase. So adiabatic state preparation will be easy. You can either just go along the red curve. You can pick some other path as long as you stay in this paramagnetic phase. It'll happen very quickly. The zero temperature point is more interesting because here the gap of the parent Hamiltonian closes, right? We're at this tricritical point and we'll have a harder time to prepare this state. And now we have a few choices, right? We can either just move along this red curve, for instance. This will be one choice. So it's kind of an appealing one because at every point, if you do this adiabatically, you'll stay in a Gibbs state just for a different temperature. So this will be some quantum analog of simulated annealing if you want. But you don't have to do this. You're completely free to just go along this green curve, for instance. And just as long as you end up at the final point that you want, this is a perfectly valid choice. And it turns out that this green curve here, maybe you don't want to make it so wiggly, but this green curve will in general perform much better. And so the high level explanation for this is just that here you're going to cross into a ferromagnetic phase. So you basically already have the correct ground state that you want. So approaching this tricritical point is going to be much easier from the ferromagnetic side than from the paramagnetic side. So now the difficulty is going to be when you cross this phase transition, but we actually do know like how hard it is to cross this phase transition. And so a careful analysis will show that this is actually has a better scaling than approaching it from the paramagnetic side. So let's look at this in a bit more detail. This is just the first point here is just to recap what I said. If we just move along this red curve, we can prepare any finite temperature Gibbs state. So finite here meaning greater than zero with this adiabatic state preparation along the red curve. We can also do it efficiently classically by running the Markov chain. Now, so we'll focus on preparing the Gibbs state at zero temperature, which, okay, maybe you take some offense calling this a Gibbs state because it's just a pure state. But yeah, let's just think of it as a Gibbs state at zero temperature. I think there's a question.
So I was wondering in the previous slide, so when you say you can take like a different path, are you imagining starting in the ferromagnetic phase or?
I'm still imagining starting in this phase where we know, the state, right? We know what the infinite temperature Gibbs state is, so It might as well be a reasonable starting point.
But in that case, won't you cross like a phase transition point and the gap closes and things go wrong?
Yes, exactly. So you will have a bottleneck at this point. That is absolutely correct. The argument that I'll give is that the bottleneck at this point is less severe than the bottleneck that you have approaching this point from the paramagnetic side.
I see. Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions right now?
Yeah, we have one from the chat.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to ask, because you were taking this example of the Gibbs distribution, does adiabatic evolution just preserve that distribution or distributions in general? Just because we're trying to sample from one probability distribution, and I want to be sure I understand how that changes as we do this adiabatic evolution.
So the important part here is that we need to be able to, for this adiabatic method, it's important that you can construct this parent Hamiltonian. You want to be able to construct a Hamiltonian whose ground state encodes the probability distribution that you're interested in. And for Gibbs distributions, there's this explicit construction that I showed you. I imagine there may be other distributions for which this is also possible. It's not something I thought about much, but I think that's the essential part. And then what you do in between, you know, how you get from your initial Hamiltonian to your final Hamiltonian, that's entirely up to you. The ground state of that could be anything. Yeah, it may not encode some, the ground state in between may in general not encode some classical Gibbs distribution, or at least classical Gibbs distribution with the local Hamiltonian. Like along this green path, there's no reason to think that, you know, the ground state here, yes, of course it encodes some probability distribution, but this may not be some physically interesting probability distribution. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I guess it does. I'll have to think more about what happens along the path, but just wanted to be clear about the role of the ground state. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, the key is that this final point, this is where we know that the ground state has this nice property that encodes the Gibbs distribution that you want. So like along this red curve, we know that this is the case. For any other state in this phase diagram, I don't know what probability distribution the ground state encodes. And in general, you know, for instance, at this phase transition, you can even argue that this will not encode a Gibbs distribution of a local classical Hamiltonian. And the argument is that the Gibbs distribution, the Gibbs state of any local classical Hamiltonian will actually have an area law, entanglement entropy, because you can actually write down a tensor network state for it. But here we actually know at these quantum phase transitions that the entanglement entropy diverges. So the ground state of this cannot be a Gibbs state of a classical Hamiltonian with classical local Hamiltonian. You can always take the logarithm of the probability distribution to get a classical Hamiltonian for it, but that's not, maybe not so interesting.
Okay, cool, thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, so then let's look at this in a bit more detail. So I think this first point, as I've said already, we can always sample at finite temperature efficient. Now, the classical Markov chain that we started from, actually you can still use it to sample at zero temperature, but now it's less efficient. You know, it's still some polynomial scaling, but it scales quadratically with the number of spins. And the physics here is just, if you have a domain wall in a system, so your state at zero temperature is just a ferromagnet. But if you start from a state that has a domain wall, this domain wall under the Markov chain is going to undergo a random walk. So it will propagate diffusively, and you'll require some time order n squared to diffuse this domain wall over the entire system to get rid of it. So that's how long the Markov chain takes. Now we can also ask, okay, adiabatic state preparation along this red curve, which is defined by this family of parent Hamiltonians. How long is that going to take? And numerically, if we find it has the same n squared scaling. So here I'm plotting the time to reach a certain fidelity, I think it's 0.999 or something like that, as a function of the number of spins. and you see it just scales quadratically with n. So it has the same scaling as classically. You don't win anything. But as I sort of already pointed out before, is that if you cross into this ferromagnet, you actually find something that scales linearly with n. So somehow you can prepare this ground state faster by going into the ferromagnetic phase and then approaching this critical point from the other side. I just want to briefly mention there's also other paths that do worse. So this blue curve here, I don't want to go into the reasons why it does worse, but so I think that the point here is you have to be careful how you choose this path. And I can also give you some physical explanation of why these paths 3 and 4 that cross into the ferromagnet do better. So I already said, so the first part of the argument is approaching this critical point is going to be much easier because you're already in almost the right ground state. So you don't have to slow down much when you approach this point, even though the gap closes. So it's kind of a bit counterintuitive, but it's just saying that, okay, the gap is small, but I'm not going to have any matrix elements to the excited states. That's roughly the argument. So I don't have to worry too much about doing this. And then you'll be dominated by the time it takes to cross into the ferromagnet. But here now we have the advantage that this is not a classical transition, it's a quantum phase transition. And we know for this model that the main walls can propagate ballistically. So if you just look at how the gap closes, the excitations, they have a linear dispersion relationship. So they really propagate ballistically, and that's why we get this linear scaling. So if you want to get rid of defects, you just need to beat this linear scaling. So in the bottom line is that we get effectively quadratic speed up from this classical n squared scaling to this linear n scaling by making use of the fact that that excitations can propagate ballistically in a quantum system with coherence, but in the classical system, they will only propagate diffusively. So, you know, this was very much a toy model now. You know, it's 1D easing model and it's actually solvable, so it's maybe not that interesting. So we tried to look at a few other problems, but you know, I'll already say right now, this will also still be toy models and we'll move beyond this a little bit later. So one, I think, particularly interesting class of models here is some constrained models. So this, what we want to do here is we want to sample from independent sets. So let me just explain what an independent set is. So imagine you have some graph as shown here. So it's vertices connected by edges. Then an independent set is just some subset of the vertices colored in red here, such that none of these red vertices share an edge. So this will be an independent set, and this is also an independent set. But I would not be able to, for instance, make this one red as well, because then it shares edges with these other red ones. So this is constraints that we impose. And now we can just define an energy for each of these independent sets, which is just a number of vertices that are in the independent set. So Ni here is 0 if the vertex is gray, and it's 1 if it's red. So the minimum energy is the state that is the largest independent set, the maximum independent set. So finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian with the independent set constraint is equivalent to finding the maximum independent set. Sorry, so it's a bit long-winded, but I hope this is clear. Now, we can just go through this previous derivation and just start with a Markov chain. We'll do single spin flips again. So in this case, we're going to try and add a vertex to this independent set or remove it, and then derive the apparent Hamiltonian. And what pops out is something quite interesting. If you're familiar with the PXP model, it's some sort of generalization of the PXP model. So we're going to have some term that assigns some energy to the independent set. So with this exponential factor, so this is just basically the Hamiltonian, the classical Hamiltonian exponentiated with this PI, which is a constraint that we have to add to make sure that we're in the independent set. And then we also have to spin flip time. And again, this PI, what it does is basically it projects onto the subspace of the neighboring vertices of I being in the ground state, being not in the independent set, because we're not allowed to flip a spin if there is any other state, a vertex nearby, or any other adjacent vertex that's already in the independent set. So this is this constraint. And if you just get rid of this first term and you put this in 1D, then people will call this the PXP model. Or not, doesn't need to be 1D, but on some graph, people would call this the PXP model. So this is sort of like a class of Hamiltonians that has received some attractions recently. So in context of quantum many-body scars and some other topics, I don't want to go into this. But I also just want to point out it's something that can actually be implemented in practice quite easily, rather than maybe these three-body interactions that we had earlier. These constraints here can be implemented in cold gases with Rydberg interactions, with the Rydberg blockade. I'm not going to go into more detail than that, but I think this makes these models quite appealing. So in this framework, we looked at a couple of other models. One of them was just a chain graph. So here, the maximum independent set is every other site is occupied. So I switch now, red is just black and white is what was gray before. So this Z2 order phase would be the maximum independent set. The Z3 order phase is another independent set, which shows up in the phase diagram of this Hamiltonian. And then again, we sort of have to look at different adiabatic paths, but I don't really want to go into detail here. But we see some similar sort of polynomial speedup that can be explained in the same language of ballistic transport as previously, with some complications because the Markov chain is now actually not no longer ergodic at zero temperature. So some subtleties there, but overall, it's very similar physics to what we saw in EPC model. We looked at another graph, which is this star graph that I've drawn here. Physics is a bit different here. It's actually not sort of this Ising type phase transition, but you find something that's more like a first order quantum phase transition. And this model is also interesting because it had a classical phase transition. So previously, the classical models we looked at, the Ising model in 1D or this independent set Hamiltonian, because they're 1D models, they don't have a finite temperature phase position. So if we want to do anything difficult, we have to go to zero temperature. But this model here actually has a finite temperature phase transition. So it's why it was kind of interesting to study. But again, I won't say much more about this other than, just highlighting maybe that all of these things are toy models where we can exactly find out this whole phase diagram. And we can figure out what should the path be that we should take based on physical grounds. We can do more or less exact numerics on all of these. So, I think they highlight some really interesting physics, but they're not per se very useful because, in order to choose the path, we need some insight of the phase diagram. And I think for more complex problems, we wouldn't expect to be able to just draw down the phase diagram, because that's probably just as hard as the problem that we're trying to solve. So I think these toy models, they highlight curious physics, and I think fascinating from that perspective. But if we want to move to hard sampling problems, we should look at something that's actually hard. And this will be sort of the next part of my talk, and I think I'll just pause here quickly to recap. So for these toy models, we found that there can be a quantum speedup with this adiabatic state preparation if you choose the path carefully. And there was some polynomial speedup depending a bit on, usually quadratic, but it could actually be more depending on how we set up on the exact problem. And I think what's also nice is that there's, through this construction, there's sort of some intriguing connections between computational complexity and quantum phases, right? Like we found these paths by drawing up the phase diagram for the parent Hamiltonian. And then we were arguing based on the nature of the quantum phase transitions, whether there could be a speed up or not for a given path. As I already sort of said, I think that the big elephant in the room is does this approach even work beyond toy models, you know, like these things that we basically can already solve exactly where we don't have to do this on a quantum computer. And you know, the main things that spring to mind here are models that are in two or more dimensions, and especially also disorder models. And so for the next few slides, I'm going to present some very preliminary data. So this is will be unpublished data that we're still trying to, you know, fully understand and figure out what's going on. And much of this work was actually done by Chris, who's a graduate student at MIT, and he's done a lot of really, you know, great work, numerical work to try and you know, look into this a little bit. But let me just pause here and see if there are any questions on what I've talked so far.
So one question I have is, so the speedups you're getting here, are they broader than what you would get by, say, using these quantum walk techniques where you encode a Markov chain into, say, a quantum walk on a larger Hilbert space?
Are they what? Sorry.
So yeah, there is the technique of like Zagady quantum walks.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Yeah. So are the speedups you're getting, are they in a more general setting than those, or are they still within the...
I think that the Zagady algorithm, as far as I know, kind of works for any Markov chain, right? And you always get this quadratic speed up.
Yep.
Correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Yep.
So I think we're not really doing much more than that. I think there was one example where we were able to get a quartic speed up, but it's a bit contrived, honestly. So quadratic speed up is sort of the generic thing that we expect as well. But our technique isn't as general, honestly. But the advantage that it had, I can't tell you that there will always be a quadratic speed up for any problem you're trying to solve. For the toy models we looked at, this seems to be the case. I think the advantage that our approach has is that, especially for these independent set series, you can actually implement this sort of fairly physically. So, you know, these Zagady algorithms, they require phase estimation and other things often.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not something you can implement on a near-term device. Whereas this Hamiltonian, you could actually just try and go ahead and implement this Hamiltonian with Rydberg atoms. So I think it's all, you know, it's a nice playground. So if you want to go and experiment a bit in the lab with these ideas, it's something that can be done. And I think Zagady's algorithm on paper is great because you can actually prove something, which I think will be hard in general here, but yeah. It will be much, much more difficult to implement until you have a fault tolerant device.
Yeah, definitely. I think these are like more practical algorithms probably. Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay, then let's look a bit at this work. So the first thing we looked at is, first, let's do no disorder, but let's move to two dimensions, just see what happens. And this time we take an easing model, classical easing model, and we wanna sample from the Gibbs distribution of that in two dimensions. So again, this is something that's exactly solvable, it's a bit more complicated, but we just wanna see what happens to the parent Hamiltonian and everything. For convenience, we actually decided to put this on a hexagonal lattice rather than a square lattice. The reason is the hexagonal lattice only has three nearest neighbors rather than four, and that makes the parent Hamiltonian slightly simpler. You don't have quite as many terms, because it turns out that these parent Hamiltonians start to get quite complicated as you increase the coordination. So what we have here now is, I've just wrote down the parent Hamiltonian, so the first two terms, I think that already explained why we have them. It's just the transverse field again and the easing term. And then, you know, the other terms, again, they just have to do with the fact that you need to check what the nearest neighbors are doing when you're trying to flip the spin. So we have this term here, which, you know, it's a bit schematic how I wrote it down, but it's a spin flip on one site, and then sigma z term on two of the adjacent sites, and then you sum over all of them. So 1, 2, 3 is just as numbered here. So you have sigma x on here, for instance, and then you have a sigma z on 2 and 3 and so on. Then you sum this over all sites. And the last one is you have this classical term of 4 sigma z that's just on one of these stars, basically. So it's already fairly complex Hamiltonian. There's a plot here. It's maybe not very useful, the sort of 3D plot, but you have a sort of rough idea of what these parameters are doing. So here I'm plotting everything renormalized by J1. So J3 over J1, H over J1, J2 over J1. You see they do something fairly complicated in this space. And then in red is highlighted the region of the parameters that are below the classical phase transition. So you know, the Gibbs distribution, the classical Gibbs distribution, will have a phase transition at some critical temperature, and that's this point. The parent Hamiltonian will have these coefficients at the phase transition. So we do expect something to happen with the parent Hamiltonian at that point, because we know that at high temperature, this Gibbs sampling or this Monte Carlo sample actually mixes fast at high temperature. So we know the parent Hamiltonian should be gapped here. And we also know that at low temperature, doing these single spin flip updates is actually very inefficient. You have an exponentially large mixing time in the system size. So here, the gap of the parent Hamiltonian will be exponentially small. We also know that just from the properties of the Markov chain, which have been studied. And this is just something that you find generically with local updates. So unless you're doing sort of these cluster updates, which have been developed for the easing model, but if you're doing local updates like single spin flip, you'll always find that in a disordered phase, things tend to mix fast, and in an ordered phase, things will mix slowly. There's sort of rigorous mathematical statements about this, just because you have long range order, single spin flip updates cannot mix fast. So this is sort of roughly the setup, and now Chris has done a lot of numerics. I'll just show you only a couple of plots. I'm sort of studying this phase diagram. So we sort of went along similar ideas what we did in 1D, but now we can't solve it exactly. So Chris did a lot of DMRG calculations, as well as some quantum Monte Carlo. So these results here are quantum Monte Carlo results. For a particular plane of this Hamiltonian in the phase diagram. So we set here J1 to 1, and then we set J2 to 0. So we just get rid of this term, makes the Hamiltonian a bit simpler, just to see what happens. And this red curve here, maybe a bit difficult to see, but this red curve here is the projection of this original curve of the parameters onto this plane. So the J1 is 0. J1 is 1 and J2 is 0. So this would just project onto this back plane here, where J2 is 0, would project onto this bottom plane. This is what we're looking at in parameter space. But if you want to look at sort of the family of parent Hamiltonians, they actually do not follow along this plane. So we have to project this curve onto this plane. So, but you know, you can already sort of roughly see what's going on. That there seem to be at least three phases which we can identify. We can identify a ferromagnetic phase up here. Can I identify a paramagnetic phase over here? And then there's something quite interesting down here, which we're still trying to fully understand, but it's a phase that seems to have a degeneracy that's exponential in the linear system size. We, as far as we understand now, it may be related to some sort of subsystem symmetry. So if you didn't have this JY term, then this is a model that's actually been studied a fair amount. So something or a related model, at least on the square lattice, which is called the Plaquette easing model, has been studied. And there you sort of find very similar physics that has this subsystem symmetry and some interesting properties. Once we add this term, this symmetry is actually broken, but somehow it seems that the features of the subsystem symmetry, some remnant of it seems to remain. And we're still trying to understand why that is and what exactly is going on. But it's again interesting that the final point along this, the zero temperature point of our parent Hamiltonian, it again seems to end in some sort of tri-critical point where these phases all come together, which I think is curious. There's an extremely rich phase diagram. This is just one of the planes. Chris has looked at other planes as well. I'm not going to show you all of the results now. But I think maybe one of the most curious findings was that the sort of there is a bit of a cryptic statement here. I have to think about it myself what I meant is. But the, one of the curious things is that actually from the properties of the Markov chain, we can actually say something about the phase diagram already, right? And I sort of hinted at this already here, right? We do know that the gap of the parent Hamiltonian has to close in this region. And we know the parent Hamiltonian has to be gapped in this blue region. So we actually, along this line of parameter space, we have a good guess. This blue line has to be fully in the paramagnetic phase because it's gapped, and we know at infinite temperature it's paramagnetic. And we also know that this red region either has to be in a gapless phase or it has to be along a phase boundary because it has no gap. And from the numerics, we seem to find that this red section lies exactly at the boundary between two quantum phases, which seem to be the ferromagnetic phase and the paramagnetic phase. We're still doing some more calculations to verify this. I think it's kind of a curious observation that just from this, if you know the critical temperature of your classical model, you can predict it's only a one-dimensional segment, but you can predict some segment of the of a phase boundary exactly in the quantum phase diagram. So yeah, these again, yeah, this 2D non-disordered easing model may not be so interesting, but I think there's some really cool physics. And again, we sort of played this game of trying to find better adiabatic paths. This time we find that, you know, just adiabatically moving along this what I call the thermal line, so this family of Hamiltonians where the ground state is always the Gibbs state. This is actually extremely slow. It's exponentially slow and has to do with the fact that the Markov chain doesn't mix well. And here we can actually get some exponential speed up because you can prepare the ferromagnetic state quickly, right? Sweep going from the from the paramagnetic phase into the ferromagnetic phase. This phase transition is still an easing type phase transition, so it's in 2D now, but it still has some polynomial gaps, so you can actually do this efficiently. And then approaching the phase boundary again from the other side doesn't seem to be so hard. So I think this is kind of interesting. It's not a disordered model. It's not a hard model. So I'm not quite sure what the implications are, but there's definitely some cool physics and some cool, so very strange quantum Hamiltonians that pop out of this construction, which is not necessarily something that expected at first. So this is sort of the 2D part without disorder, and we're also currently working on trying to understand disorder. So here we made a different simplification. We said, okay, let's get rid of all these extra terms. Let's first try and understand a bit how sort of quantum annealing adiabatic state preparation works in generic disorder 2D systems. There's been a lot of work on this, sort of in the context of, I think much of this was triggered by what D-Wave was doing, or maybe still is doing for a long time. People start to think about this, the original proposals of quantum annealing, but I think there are not that many generic statements or general statements about what happens. It's very hard to make general statements. I don't think this is something that that will apply to generic models, but so we're just trying to sort of explore this right now, just numerically, try and get a bit of a sense of what may be possible here. And so Chris has been studying sort of this disordered easing model so far, just ferromagnetic, because there are some results on what happens to the gap in that case, analytical results. Eventually we'll make this frustrated as well, so there'll be some anti-ferromagnetic terms here. It's still not a hard problem, right? Like the ground state or the even sampling from the Gibbs state is easy for this model, but at least it has some disorder now. And then so far we've just done sort of adiabatic sweeps of the transverse field. So we start with a very large transverse field and then sweep it to zero and see what sort of the final ground state fidelity that we get as a function of the total evolution time for different system sizes. So I don't know if you can read it, but here we go from sort of 4x4, 5x5, all the way up to 10x10 systems. And this was done with sort of snake MPS simulations, TDVP. which seems to work reasonably well, even up to sort of relatively long times. So these last couple of points you can ignore. I think this is where the algorithm hasn't quite converged yet. What's neat about this is there's actually some rescaling of all of this data. If we just rescale the time in some funny way, so we take the logarithm of the time and we divide by the square root of the length, the linear size of the system, then this data just completely collapses. And what that tells us in some ways is that, and you can also get this by looking at how long does it take to reach a certain fidelity. What this tells us is that the time to prepare the ground state seems to scale as an exponential of the square root of the linear size of the system, which I think an interesting, unexpected result. There have been similar reports for other systems. I've not seen it for the 2D easing model, but there have been similar reports for other systems that seem to have this stretched exponential. They seem to appear often in disordered systems. I'm not an expert really in this, but there's something we're exploring right now. And I think this needs to be contrasted with sort of classical simulated annealing. We're also not quite sure about if this is true, so take this with a grain of salt, but we actually think that we don't get these stretched exponentials there typically, but we get something that's more like exponential in the system size. And this is just based on the observation that even if you don't have disorder, you get this exponential scaling. So it's hard to imagine that disorder somehow makes things easier. So yeah, it seems like there's some fairly large speed up here, I think, which I think this is somewhat known. Like, this is not necessarily a new result, and this is something why people have were initially excited about quantum annealing. One should also be cautious because simulated annealing may just not be the best classical algorithm for this. And there are other algorithms. I think one of the contenders here is quantum simulated annealing, where you do sort of quantum Monte Carlo together with some time-dependent parameters. And that tends to mirror better the performance of quantum annealing itself. So yeah, we're not, I just want to point out here, we're not making any claims that we can get some exponential speed up here. But I think to try and understand better what we'll expect for sampling from these disorder models, we first have to understand what happens in sort of these generic systems and if there is any structure to it at all. And it's a problem that's been studied, but I think for sort of these large scale numerics, this is not something that many people have done yet. So there's definitely more room to collect more results. So with this, I think my time is up. Now I want to wrap up here as well. So let me just briefly summarize what the talk was about. So with these toy models, I showed you that we can get some speed up for classical sampling. And I shall say speed up over simulated anything or over this sort of Markov chain Monte Carlo. And there are, of course, for these 1D systems, they're much better algorithms. You would never do this Markov chain Monte Carlo. So in that case, there would be no speed up. But I think we compared with simulated annealing because it's still believed that for some generic, or it's still a go-to algorithm for generic sampling problems. If you have no idea what the structure of the problem is, you'll just throw simulated annealing at it, for instance, or just some Monte Carlo algorithm. I think there's this really cute connection between sort of these quantum phase diagrams and how hard it is to sample. It's of course in general hard to construct these quantum phase diagrams, but I think it's still worth trying. And I think we've seen that if we look at harder problems, then it's much harder to construct these phase diagrams, much harder to sort of figure out what's really going on, but there's also really rich physics happening. So this is really why we're exploring this. It's maybe just, we don't really know where this is going yet, but there seems to be much to be discovered. And I think the final point I want to point out that I think will be quite interesting to explore further is, if you already have access to a quantum device that can implement these Hamiltonians, can you somehow use that to offload part of the hard work onto the quantum device, where you use the quantum device itself to to tell you something about the phases that are there, right? You can do some of these sweeps. You can do something variational maybe to try and optimize the sweep. You can try and map out the phase diagram in some ways. And we're sort of thinking about whether this would be another way to tackle this problem. With this, let me just thank the people involved. So it's sort of the work mostly on these toy models was sort of this top row of people. You can read up on this in more detail here in these papers. Now, you know, the more recent numerical results were prepared by Chris. And yeah, that's it. Thank you. And I'll of course be happy to answer any more questions.
Great, so let's all thank Dominic for a really interesting talk. He had plenty of questions during the talk, but does anyone have any further questions? Just unmute yourself.
Yes, hi, I have a question. So maybe I missed it, but I assume that most of the, you said that there's a quantum speed up for preparing the deep state, and I assume that you're saying talking about the state that's off the critical point. And I'm also curious, like say, is there also a quantum speed up when you're trying to prepare your classical Gibbs ensemble at the critical point?
So which model are you thinking about now? These one models?
No, just 2D easy model. 2D easy
model. 2D easy model.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what I think, yeah, I was a bit cautious there because, you know, this is somewhat preliminary results, but yeah, it seems to, so what we do know is if you just run the Markov chain, the classical Markov chain algorithm at a temperature below the phase transition, it mixes very slowly. Yeah, there's sort of rigorous proofs that the mixing time is exponential in the linear system size. And it just has to do with the fact that you have long range order, but only local updates. So you end up just having these domains and you can't get rid of the domains. It takes a really long time to get rid of the domains. Mm-hmm. So based on that, we actually also believe that doing just quantum annealing along this family of Hamiltonians, just as a function of beta, we believe that's also very slow. Just because previously we always saw they seem to have the same scale. You're doing some, yeah, that it's very close to what you're doing classically in simulated. So we don't believe that there's any speed up there. What we also know is that it is possible to efficiently just prepare the ferromagnetic ground state from the paramagnet. By crossing the phase transition. So starting from a point in the paramagnet, you can just adiabatically cross this phase transition. And this is possible in time that's just only polynomial in the system size because the gap here only closes polynomial. So this we know. Now the question is, okay, you wanna actually prepare the true Gibbs state. So you'll have to come back to this red graph, right? You have to tune your parameters back such that it's HQ of beta at the final beta that you want. And so the hard part's going to be approaching this critical line again. We do have some numerics that this seems to be not too bad. And I think intuition is, again, you know, you're already in the correct phase, like you already have the correct ground state that corresponds to the classical ground state. So maybe it's not so difficult, but I'm reluctant to make any strong claims at this point that it's definitely possible. I think our numerics are a little too weak at this stage that this is possible.
Okay, thank you.
But I mean, intuitively also, like, you're not preparing the hard state, right? You're preparing the ground state of a ferromagnet. So in some ways, the strategy that we have is just a really, not a very smart one to prepare the ground state of the
ferromagnet. I guess even for the classical Monte Carlo, when you're trying to study the critical point, there's this problem about like the critical slowing down. So I was just curious, say, if there's any possible, like what you were describing, some quantum speed up when you were trying to prepare this.
You want to go exactly to the critical point?
Yeah.
That is an interesting question. It's not something we've looked at, so I really don't know. A very good question.
So can you tell us a bit more about the subsystem symmetries of the model you've got on the screen? What do they look like?
So the subsystem symmetries, so what we notice is, so get rid of the J1 term and the J2 term. And so we only have this H and we have this term, which is just these sort of stars.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's imagine you just, let's draw a horizontal line across like this. And then you take an operator, which is the product of the X operators on this side, 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 just along the line. Mm-hmm. Basically every bond that's crossed, the vertices that are attached to it, you take the sigma X.
Okay.
Now you can see pretty easily that will commute with the Hamiltonian, right? It certainly commutes with the sigma X term. And you can also check that it will always have, you know, each term here, there will always be either zero or two sigmas X. So it will also commute with this term. So then that's a subsystem symmetry. And you can now do this also along this diagonal and this diagonal. And so it's very similar to what people have done in sort of square lattices, where this sigma Z term is just sort of a Cliquet term. Mm-hmm. Here it's not quite a Cliquet, it's the star, but it's probably more or less equivalent. And then so you get a very similar phase diagram with sort of these fractal-like excitations. And what's still puzzling us a bit is when you add this term here, you're actually breaking the symmetry. Right, you still have a highly degenerate ground state, that we can sort of understand from what these terms do, but well, you have a highly degenerate ground state when you have these two terms, but we don't quite know what happens when we have all three terms at the same time, and seems a bit tricky to analyze. We've not found, so numerically we can look at stuff, but. We've not fully understood what all three terms do together. And this is kind of what you need to do to understand this phase transition here, right? So the H equals zero axis is kind of easy. The J1 equals zero thing is also, you know, relatively straightforward to understand. All three terms together seems a bit tricky.
Thanks. Yeah, very interesting. Do we have any further questions? Okay, if not, let's all thank Dominic once again for a really nice talk.